call the meeting to order. Quorum is not present, but we're going to get started anyway. First, what we'd like to do is with special recognition, Representative Poppy, would you like to recognize the individual today?
I would, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this was, we talked about this a little bit earlier. Was this last week? The weeks go by now. But I'm very pleased to be able to read this House resolution honoring Minnesota Grain and Feed Association Executive Director Bob Zielinka. Whereas agriculture remains a pillar of the Minnesota economy and the cultivation and distribution of grain facilitates many other areas of agriculture across the entire United States, and whereas Bob Zielinka serves as Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, a nonprofit association composed of competing cooperative and independent grain elevators and feed mills in Minnesota, and whereas he earned his bachelor's and master's degrees at Minnesota State University Mankato, and whereas Bob worked as a transportation and land use planner with the Region 9 Development Commission, where he facilitated a $22 million rehabilitation of the Milwaukee Road rail line from Alden to Jackson, and whereas he is an active past president of the National Agricultural Association Executives Council and the Midwest Society of Association Executives, and whereas he currently serves as chairman of the board for the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center, Farm America, and as a member of the Minnesota Freight Advisory Committee created by the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and whereas he has served on the board of directors for the Minnesota Agriculture in the Classroom Foundation, and whereas Bob created and managed the Midwest Shippers Association and continues to provide management services for the Northwest Feed Manufacturers Association and the Agricultural Cooperative Safety Directors Association of Minnesota, and whereas Bob's knowledge and experience of agricultural logistics recently helped to avert a rail capacity crisis in Minnesota. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives of the State of Minnesota that it recognizes Bob Zielinka for dedication and expertise in the field of grain and feed production and distribution. It's dated February 16, 2015. It's signed by the Speaker of the House, Kurt Dowd, the Chair of the Rules and Legislative Administration, Joyce Pepin, Rod Hamilton, the Chair of the Ag Finance Committee, and it will be signed by Sandra Mason, State Representative. So, Mr. Zielinka, a very duly noted honor for you.
Absolutely. Members, please join us in congratulating. We do have a quorum, and for the individuals maybe new to the committee, we like to recognize someone special in agriculture at the beginning of every committee meeting, and we're spreading it all across the state. So if you have any ideas or suggestions, please bring them forward, because we'd love to recognize those people. We have a pretty busy agenda. We're going to move in with testimony from Farm Credit Services, the way it looks, and AgStar Financial Services. If you'd like to state your name for the record and begin, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Paul Coles. I'm with AgStar Financial Services.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Nisley from United FCS.
Mr. Chairman, Jessica Fury with Ag Country Farm Credit.
Could we get the name one more time? I'm sorry.
Jessica Fury.
Fury. All right. Thank you so much. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. Minnesota Farm Credit is here at the Capitol today for our Day on the Hill, and we're happy to be here today to provide the committee with an agricultural, economic, and credit outlook. I work for AgStar Financial Services. The other Mark Nisley is the CEO of United Farm Credit out of Wilmer, and Jessica is with Ag Country out of Fargo. We're the three farm credits that provide retail lending services to farmers and agribusiness across Minnesota. Mark is going to start by providing a little bit of very short history, and then we're going to take a look at the current economic situation, and spend a little time at the end talking about what lenders are doing as we deal with our clients across the state of Minnesota. Mark?
Mr. Nisley.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm going to throw you for a little loop today, because I am Mark Nisley, but Mark with a C and Nisley with a K, so unlike your esteemed administrator there. So
it's Mark Knisley?
Yes, that's probably the best way to do it, to keep it straight. So. I know the directors, the association directors we have here will remind me of that later over the course of the day as well. So, but it's an honor to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We wanted to go through just a brief overview of kind of what's happened over the course of the last 3 years in particular, but the economic experience that agriculture has had over the last number of years. And the slides that were provided, we just wanted to give you a few highlights and note that the highest market year average corn and soybean prices have ever been recorded happened in the last 3 years. We've had the highest calendar year average prices for the poultry industry, beef cattle, feeder cattle, and milk ever recorded during the past 3 years. Record high margin over feed costs for the animal protein sector and recorded in 2014. All of that has happened with the lowest debt to asset ratio ever experienced since USDA has been collecting that data, and we've seen, as you know, a boom in farmland values. Some of the new realities that we're seeing now, that we've experienced all of those records and positives, we note that there was record corn and soybean production. We did have in 2014, we did have pockets within the state, obviously, that had adversity and didn't experience that, but from a national standpoint, we had record production. We've noted a slowdown in export demand. The value of the U.S. dollar and just the global economic growth, the situation in Russia and Ukraine have all tended to hurt exports of agricultural products and cause a downturn there. And finally, while the U.S. economy is turning the corner, wage growth is still lagging. And we think that the U.S. domestic ethanol production has started to level off because we've hit that E10 blend wall that you're all familiar with. Before Paul gets into some more of the detail with the graphs and the charts that we've included, I just wanted to mention a couple of other key macroeconomic factors. Russian situation, but also China slowing down as they convert from an industrial to more of a consumption-based economy. The European Union, and I know that Greece was in the news again this morning with all the dialogue and controversy going on there with the EU. The U.S. economy is doing better than most. Obviously, that increases the value of the dollar relative to other currencies. So the U.S. continues to assume a role of safe haven for global investors. So we see a lot of investment coming into this country. And lastly, the crash in crude oil prices and what that has meant in terms of consumer spending and the ability of consumers to have more money for necessities such as food and agricultural products. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Paul to review some of the graphs and charts that we've included.
Thank you. Mr. Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. members, I'm certainly not an economist. I'll let you ask any really difficult questions of Dr. Burr when he's up in front of the committee. But I did pull some slides that came from various resources, the Fed, our bank, AgriBank that we work with, and others. So I'm going to walk through a number of these very quickly. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions, but again, I'll defer the tough ones to Dr. Burr. The first slide here shows where interest rates are at, and we saw interest rates have been at a historic low for an extended period of time. They started to inch up in 2013, and somewhat unexpectedly, we saw them start to decline again as we moved through 2014. So interest rates, the U.S. Treasury, which we can think of as a proxy for lending rates, certainly they're not identical. Loan rates are going to be higher than what the U.S. Treasury, but they tend to often follow the 10-year Treasury. So interest rates have been low, and they remain low. Mark mentioned a little bit the challenge with the rising dollar, and a large percentage, as you all know, of American agricultural production is now exported. And the value of the dollar has a significant impact on the affordability of those products across the globe. And so as we see the strengthening dollar, we'll need to watch for and be mindful of the challenges that some of our foreign markets are going to have as those commodities that we're looking to sell become more expensive for foreign buyers. The next slide here shows the average corn price. Mark mentioned that we had a high, record high corn price in 2013, and we saw really a precipitous drop in that corn price. Some might suggest that that it's been normalized, but in any event, it has had a direct and significant impact on farmers across the state of Minnesota on their bottom line. The corn price is projected, if you look forward a number of years, is projected to remain flat, and farmers are going to continue to be challenged to meet their cost of production with the corn that they're marketing. Similar story as it relates to soybeans. Again, high prices in 13, record high prices, and a significant drop off in prices. So again, our corn and bean farmers across the state of Minnesota are going to continue to be challenged to meet their cost of production with land rents where they're at, with input costs where they're at, the price that our farmers are getting for the commodities continue to be challenged. The next slide shows the real dramatic story that we've seen in dairy. Again, Mark mentioned that we had some record prices in dairy, and a really great year for dairy producers in 2013, all the way through the month of November, and prices started to tail off fairly significantly in December. And the price in January is below cost of production for most producers. So despite a very strong run for the dairy industry throughout 2014 and, in fact, back into 2013, our dairy producers across the state of Minnesota are looking at some challenging times moving forward. The next slide here shows the annual farm machinery and equipment loan volume. As lenders, obviously, we're interested in where loan volume is at. You'll see a spike in 2012 as producers had made significant amounts of money, and they invested that money. They turned around and invested in equipment to run their operations. We've seen those numbers soften, and if you look at the next slide here, despite the fact that lending is down on both land and machinery, the good news, both from a lender's perspective and I think absolutely from a producer's perspective as well, is that delinquency rates are very low across the ag lending sector. So our farmers are, although they're challenged today with the current economics, most of them have very strong working capital positions. They've got high equity in their operations, and as a result, they've been able to stay current on their debt. The next slide, there's been a lot of talk over the last many years about the rise in land prices. We've seen significant increases in land prices across the state of Minnesota, probably most pronounced in southwestern Minnesota, but we have seen significant growth, and that's softened, largely as a result, I think, of the overall changing economic perspective for agriculture. But AgriBank does a survey, and prices are down almost 9% in Minnesota year over year. With that, I'm going to turn it back to Mark to wrap up with
Excuse me, we do have a question. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coles, I'll throw you a softball. Could you look ahead the next year or two and tell us what you see ahead for input costs for agriculture?
Mr. Coles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure that's much of a softball. I wish I could predict. I think historically we've seen that input costs lag a bit behind the commodity prices. So if the prices remain depressed. We would anticipate seeing those come down a bit, but it's probably a better question for the maybe a better question for some of Mr. Zelenka's clients.
Representative Anderson, follow up. No, Mr. Coles, continue.
I'm going to actually, Mr. Chairman, if I could turn it back to Mr. Knisely, he's going to wrap up our presentation.
Mr. Knisely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We really thought the value that we could bring to a hearing like this today is the kind of giving you the flavor of what's going on in rural Minnesota in terms of agriculture. And while we have had, we have experienced really a wonderful run in terms of income and so forth in rural America, rural Minnesota, and agriculture, clearly we're going to likely have some hurdles and some worsening conditions that we're going to need to deal with in 2015. As Paul indicated in some of his slides, we've locally seen real estate values off 10 to 20% in some cases. And while that sounds dire, we don't anticipate a hard landing with real estate values. We really think that, that real estate values are going to have kind of a soft landing in terms of agriculture, so we're not anticipating a significant and a rapid decrease in land values, just a correction. Large equipment, particularly large horsepower tractors and combines, are off about 10 or 15% in value. And again, from an input standpoint, that's a good thing if you're purchasing them. Keeps your costs lower, but if you do have equipment to trade or sell, it's going to harm your asset base there. Land rents that we've been tracking have been fairly steady, actually, even with the decline in commodity prices. But we do anticipate just probably a correction of about $25 an acre or so this year. We've seen significant losses in working capital with the operations we've met with so far this year. In a lot of cases, we've had some production problems across the state with corn and soybean producers. But any inventory that was being carried from the 2013 crop for sale in 2014, if they didn't take advantage of that short window where prices were high, those losses are now showing up in the working capital and the liquidity positions of our farm operations. Then I'll just throw out the break-evens for corn and soybeans across most of the state. Corn's about $4.30 a bushel, and soybeans are about $12 a bushel. If you compare those back to the slide that Mr. Cole shared earlier on the anticipated forecast values for corn and soybeans, you can see we're significantly below that for at least the next 2 to 3 years. So while we expect losses in 2015, we're anticipating that losses will likely continue into 2016 and 2017. All of that said, all it takes is a major drought somewhere in the world, and commodity price forecasts can change significantly. So given what we know today and what the forecasts are, we're anticipating pretty significant losses, particularly for our corn and soybean operators over the next couple of years. The great news is, as Paul indicated, the interest rates continue to be very low. The cost of funds that financial institutions access to re-lend to agriculture are very favorable, and we don't anticipate significant changes or increases in interest rates into the near future here. I know the Fed keeps talking about raising interest rates, and they'll likely take some action based on what we've heard from some economists that we've heard over the course of the first quarter here, simply to show that they're willing to take action. But we don't think that there's any impending rapid increase in interest rates likely around the corner. And to your question, Representative Anderson, the lower oil prices we think should help with input costs, but again, that all takes time to kind of get through the system. And as Mr. Coles indicated, the input costs do tend to follow commodity prices quite often, so hopefully with commodity prices being lower, we'll see the input costs go down for a number of the inputs for farmers. So.
Thank you, Mr. Knisely. We do have a question. Representative Sundin.
On page 8 of the handout here, slide so labeled chart 7, you get a downturn in the loan volume in 2014. How concerning is that as far as people looking for money to purchase equipment, that type of thing? Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, Mr. Knisely.
Mr. Coles, I think in 2014, particularly in the state of Minnesota, producers already knew that we had a challenging spring, so they were a little concerned about potential yields being off the trend line. So I believe that not only did commodity prices tumble and producers were keeping an eye on that, there were parts of the country that were suffering from either not getting a crop in a prevented planting situation or getting a crop it planted very late because of the spring that we had. So I think it's a reflection of kind of two areas that resulted in that decrease. Now, if you're an equipment dealer, it can be pretty concerning. If you're a car dealership and or selling trucks and so forth to agriculture and farm families, it could be concerning. So that balance, we'll need to find out where that balance is. But clearly, the economic situation for rural Minnesota and agriculture will be impacted, and the economic engine that was in place that I think agriculture kind of drove over the course of the last 3 to 5 years is going to sputter a little bit here, and every business in rural Minnesota is going to feel it.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You piqued my interest on another subject here. The equipment that's being used and purchased, how much of that is used equipment? How much is new equipment? And I'm just wondering if there's any way we can generate more used equipment being repaired and that would help the farmers economically, you know, the thing. Used equipment at a reduced rate, let's say if someone threw a bill in to exempt sales tax on used equipment, would that spur more repair on the machinery and farmers would benefit from that?
Mr. Nisley.
We should have one of our farmer directors up here answering that question for you. Farmers are very resourceful business people. So they're going to equip at an adequate level, and when they need to buy new equipment, they buy new equipment. When they can get by fixing equipment and using used equipment or purchasing used equipment, obviously all new equipment that goes out of the off the dealership lot typically has a trade-in on it, so that used market has been pretty significant over the course of the last decade as well. To your specific question, I guess I'd have to give some thought to that as to what would help spur that. But.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. There was a bill dropped last week. Have a look at it, and I'd like to talk to you about it.
We will do that today. Thank you.
Nice. All right, thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here, gentlemen. The question that I have is, it's kind of a global question. We're talking about, you know, some difficult times ahead or rough times ahead in the ag sector. And when you started talking about, rural communities and so forth, and Mr. Chair, I think it'll be interesting what the February forecast shows and how that's incorporated into, our decisions here in the legislature. But I'm just curious to know what you think that the overall impact could be on state revenues, you know, with regards to sales tax and income taxes and stuff like that. Is there any metric that you use to determine stuff like that? I mean, agriculture is obviously one of the very, very largest economic engines in the state. I'm just wondering what you think about
Mr. Bowles or Mr. Nisley?
You can go first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I think I don't have a great answer. Hopefully, Mr. Nisley does. A slower rural economy, a slower agricultural economy is going to have impacts on, state tax receipts. If there are fewer new pieces of equipment being purchased or less. Less economic activity, that's likely to result in lower state revenues. I don't know that I have a metric that I can point you to, but I don't know, Mr. Nisley, maybe you have more.
Mr. Nisley.
The multiplier effect works when incomes are high and that money's being spent and respent in communities. The same thing's going to be true when the income is lower. And clearly it's going to impact tax receipts, I think, for the state. I don't know how it can't, because it's not, as Mr. Coles indicated, it's not just the income from the farmers themselves and the tax on that. It's the income that everyone makes, from the salesperson at the car dealership or the equipment dealership to, you know, pulling a few less hours at the grocery store because, you know, or that the hardware store or the lumber yard because construction and things have slowed. So it's going to rifle through the whole rural community, and I think it will, in fact, probably impact tax rate receipts in a negative way.
Representative Fabian, follow up? Mr. Coles, we're going to direct all our questions to Ms. Theory from now on. I'm just kidding. So, Mr.
Chair,
she'll
probably have better answers than I will. Mr. Chair, I think that. Mr. Knisely just has one last slide here to.
Mr. Knisely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to lay out here the from a lender response. The good news is that I think all the agricultural lenders across the state have been very proactive. We've been very conservative in our lending practices leading up to this downturn in the commodity market. We've been managing and helping to advise customers to manage their debt levels, manage their balance sheets, go into this. We know that agriculture is cyclical. We know that agriculture is very volatile. And making sure that our producers had a good working capital position going into this cycle was very important to all of us as lenders. So the agricultural community is well established to move into this cycle, and the lenders, I believe, have adequate capital and resources to help and assist our producers going forward. So we will use a lot of the tools that are available, both USDA tools with FSA guarantees and those types of things, as well as farmer lender mediation if we have issues or situations where we have customers facing adversity out there. So we believe that people are, that farmers are well positioned. It is going to be a struggle for some, though. So
Mr. Knisely, how is the crude oil prices, with those fallen, how will that positively or negatively impact the ethanol industry? If you, or Mr. Coles, do you have any idea how that'll impact it? So,
Mr. Chair, that may be one I'm going to defer to Dr. Burr.
Okay.
Unless Mark, if you have.
No, that's fair enough. I didn't know. I was just.
Well, it'll.
Yes, Mr. Knisely.
You know, ethanol as an end product is tied to the price of petroleum, obviously. So there is a connection there. The value of the input, the corn and the purchasing, that the things that the inputs that the ethanol production facilities have to purchase have come down, obviously, with the price of corn being down. But ethanol does track somewhat with petroleum. So we have seen lower returns with these ethanol facilities, in part because of the lower crude oil prices. So.
Well, Mr. Knisely, the reason I bring that up is somewhere on record, probably, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I raised a concern that I thought with rising gas prices that it would, something similar would happen that happened overseas when that went very, very high for a long period of time, and then it crashed, and then the ethanol industry crashed along with it, and then they were bought up by a lot of the various oil companies subsequently after that. And so I raised that concern years ago, and I didn't know if that had any validity, if you would. Mr. Knisely.
Well, I think the timing of that situation had a lot to do with it as well, because a lot of the ethanol plants were fairly new at that point in time, and they had limited equity. They were carrying a fair amount of debt, so the leverage was quite high on a lot of these ethanol facilities at that point in time. Plus, not only did petroleum prices drop, but their input costs went up significantly because of the price of corn. So. And natural gas, and a lot of these plants operate with natural gas as a heat source, which is good. It's been a low cost input for these ethanol facilities. But much like our grain and soybean producers over the last number of years, ethanol plants have really done a good job of paying down debt and getting their balance sheet in line so they can handle these cycles better. So I'm not sure that we have the same kinds of exposure that we did when that last cycle hit.
But thank you.
Great question.
Thank you, Mr. Knisely. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I want to circle back for a minute to Representative Sundin's bill and the past 2-year cycle that here in the legislature with regards to farm equipment repairs and sales tax, and maybe fiscal staff can refresh my memory anyway as to what taxes How have the taxes on sales tax changed in the past couple of years with regards to equipment repair on used equipment and so forth? It's my recollection that there was a whole bunch of new taxes put in place in 2013, and then in 2014, some were repealed. And if memory serves me correctly, and maybe some other smart people in the room can help me out here too a little bit, that tax was repealed. So Representative Sundin, and we can have an offline conversation, but somebody help me out here with what's going on, or
thank
what
you
has happened.
So,
Mr. Chair and members, I can talk to tax staff within the fiscal department and get back to you with those answers. But I'm not aware of, or I'm not sure about the impacts at this time.
Thank you. Representative Fabian?
Mr. Chair, well, if you would indulge me, is there anybody else in the room that can, who's kind of more connected to the farm and ag community than I am on a day-to-day basis that can help us out with that?
Is there anybody from the... Anybody like to come up and answer that question? So I can tell you
they're all like my 10th graders. They used to be in class, Mr. Chair. They're not saying anything when I have a question.
Right. We have somebody moving up front. So, Mr. Goles. So we are going to wrap this part up in about 7 minutes. We do have two more questions as well. But if you'd please state your name for the record and attempt to answer Mr. Fabian, represent Fabian's question, if you would, please.
My name is Kevin Copendreyer. I'm a director with AgStar and currently the chairman of the Minnesota Legislative Committee. And most of those members are represented here.
Welcome.
Directly to those taxes, there is no income tax, or I'm sorry, there is no sales tax currently on newer used equipment. You know, more importantly than that, I think, would be the income tax. And the reason I say that is it's income generated, you know, if I back up, sales tax is 7.5%, 7.6, whatever. Income tax, on the other hand, is very much higher than that. And so when the farmers are making more money, they are paying more income tax. When the farmers are making more money, they're also buying more used equipment. Farmers in general are not very good at saving money per se. We put that money back into the economy all the time. They're constantly, even when they're paying down debt, they're also upgrading facilities and equipment, and that money's going back into the economy. Earlier there was a question about crop inputs and what the crop inputs and the outlook would be. You know, nobody can directly say or for sure what crop input prices will be or what they will do. I can tell you that I farm approximately 2,000 acres. I also am a seed sales representative for Pioneer Seed. I sell a significant amount of seed corn. I can tell you that Pioneer, as one of the leading companies, will actually come out and say, we're not going to lower the price of our seed, even now. They just come out and say, don't look for seed to go down. It's not going to go down. They price the seed according to what they call value. And they see the value in their product, and so they're going to price it higher. Also, while we've seen commodity prices drop pretty dramatically in the last year, I held off on prepaying, or I thought about holding off on prepaying my crop inputs because I felt that with the situation with ag, that we would see a decline in fertilizer prices. Fertilizer prices actually rose. I did actually prepay my input as much as I could. I think you're going to see input costs still maintaining or going up. I don't know why fertilizer costs went up, but at different local co-ops and distributors, fertilizer prices have actually increased, not decreased, since last November. The other one is fuel. Fuel right now, we talked about fuel, and you know, fuel costs right now are a little lower than I've seen in quite a few years. The significance of that, however, is fuel is one of our lowest costs. You know, if you took a per acre cost of each of your investments made to put in your crop, and you could say, well, wow, but the cost of fuel is cheap. Maybe, but feel is relative. You know, nothing is insignificant, but relatively insignificant, and I hope that helps.
Thank you, Mr. Copendreyer. We do have two more questions, and we're going to wrap this up. Representative Anderson, then Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment, I guess, and another question. I think what farmers are concerned about is that when corn was going up to $7 a bushel and the input prices were going up as well, the companies that supplied those wanted a piece of that $7 a bushel big price of corn. But now as the price of corn has come back down again and that piece of money has gotten significantly smaller, I don't see the same attitude or appetite to lower the input costs as that price of our commodities has gone down. That was my comment. My question, Mr. Knisely, your break-even numbers are certainly concerning. At my local elevator, we're about 70 cents a bushel under the break-even price on corn. Soybeans about $2.50 lower. You mentioned that some farmers would be struggling this year. From a 30,000-foot level of question, will there be some farmers who will not get operating money this year, do you think?
Mr. Knisely.
Representative Anderson, I believe that for the most part, farm producers are fairly, have really built up a strong bank to go through this first part of the cycle, so I don't think we'll see a lot of foreclosures or corrections or forced sales. I believe that we're not hearing, at least in western Minnesota, of anyone not receiving operating money. So I think that the financial institutions are going to work with the producers. It's probably year two and three that are the more severe. But again, that's assuming that commodity prices follow the forecast trend line that's been established. A lot of things can happen over the course of the year from a production standpoint. But.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another question or comment, maybe just based on the recent discussion before I ask my other one, which is maybe this committee could investigate and find out what are the factors why the fertilizers and the seeds are not going down in price. It seems like that might be a service we could do to our farmers. Why? I think you asked the question why, or Mr. Copendreyer asked the question why, and I'm wondering if this committee could help find an answer. I did have another question. I had the chance, I think Representative Keel and I went to hear a farm economist talk over at the Department of Ag. It was partly during, and you were there too, I believe, during the time of the committee, so we missed some of the committee, but one of the things I was remembering is that our exports to certain countries are really a big part of our farm income, huge, and I don't have the number in my head right now, but it's very big, and one of the countries, I think our number one country of export is China, if I'm not mistaken. And I have a question because I've been trying to investigate this, but I know that China has rejected some of our soybeans and alfalfa because of GMO-related issues, and I'm just wondering if you are tracking that or you know what the cost is in terms of lost export value on that. And I think there's 64 countries that require labeling of GMO products, and 30 countries that actually ban it. So some of our farm exports are not able to go to those countries. And I don't know if any of your organizations are involved in tracking that, but I'm interested in learning more about that.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Mr. Coles or Mr. Knisely?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the issue we saw with China last year related to some GMO corn, there was a couple of shipments that China rejected. Soybean imports have continued to be strong to Southeast Asia, and China's recently approved the GMO trait that they had previously rejected. And so the situation of exports is a real challenge for agriculture. It's a real opportunity for agriculture, but it's also a challenge. There's economic challenges associated with the rising price of the dollar. We talked about
that
earlier.
Excuse me, Representative Coles, just for a minute. Before they leave, I'd like to recognize our friends from Farmers Union. We have Farmers Union Day at the Capitol here, so we have members from southwestern Minnesota and central. And welcome. Thank you. I was hoping to recognize you earlier. So. Have a good day. I'm so sorry, Mr. Coles, but I wanted to recognize them before they left.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, in addition to the economic issues. There certainly are some geopolitical issues, challenges that American agriculture has to be mindful of. We have seen not only China but other purchasers of U.S. agricultural products change their view on whether it's a particular genetic traits or other issues. Mr. Nisley mentioned that the challenges right now in Russia with their economy, the situation they have with Ukraine, their decision to stop importing U.S. products because of the sanctions that the U.S. government placed on Russia. So it's both an economic issue and a geopolitical issue. I don't think we can point to any one particular issue as controlling.
Thank you. We're going to do a hard break at the top of the hour and bring up our next testifiers. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't belabor this, but I know that there's also some positive impacts from non-GMO, too. So at some point, I just would like to know a little bit more about what our lenders know about that.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Bly?
All right. I'll try to be quick.
So all right. Thank you. Representative Bly.
Since you were talking about exports and foreign countries interested in our products, there's been some purchasing of processing by foreign countries as well. And, of course, with the downturn in our ag economy, that might be more interesting to some foreign owners. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about the impact of that on our farm economy.
Thank you, Representative Bly. Mr. Nisley?
Representative Bly, in terms of production agriculture, obviously within the state, foreigners can't own farms and real estate. So that sector of agriculture is pretty insulated from that. We have seen some foreign purchasing of manufacturing facilities and consolidation in that area, but that has not been significant from our vantage point, at least, and we don't anticipate that being a major factor going forward.
Thank you. Ms. Theory, Mr. Nisley, Mr. Coles, thank you so much for your testimony. We greatly appreciate it, and you're welcome to come back and visit us anytime. So thank you.
Thank you.
So next we'll have the University of Minnesota. We have Dean Brian Boer with us, I think. Are you going to be kicking us off? So please, if our friends from the university would make their way up, that would be... It'd be great. We have 1 hour. Dean Boer, we have 1 hour. And we will end on time. So. Please state your name for the record and begin, if you would, please.
Chair Hamilton, I'm Brian Boer. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences and Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Michael Schmidt, Associate Dean for the University of Minnesota Extension.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, I'm Trevor Ames, Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Welcome. Please, if you'd begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for inviting us to present today to the committee and committee members. We've already introduced ourselves, so in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I'll move ahead quickly. Dean Beverly Durgan is here as well. She has a sore throat today, so we won't hear from her directly, but I know that she certainly supports this as well, so I wanted to recognize her. Minnesota, of course, as we all know, this committee is a critical part of the state's economy. Just in this first slide, two things. That it's about 10% of the GDP, so to the questions about what the impact of a downturn is, you can basically multiply any decreases to that 10% and figure out what that is. Also want to recognize that forestry is a key part of our agriculture, our production systems in Minnesota, and growth. Those two combined have contributed significantly to Minnesota's economy over the past few years, and particularly as we went through some of the downturns we expressed in other areas, it was a nice counter-cyclical gain to that. We do want to recognize, of course, that the state of Minnesota is a key partner with us. This represents the Ag State special funding that comes to the University of Minnesota through the state. In addition to the O&M dollars and other funds, so a key part of our funding to do the agricultural research that we conduct. And that funding goes through both Extension and through the Agricultural Experiment Station, and within the Agricultural Experiment Station that includes our college, CFANS, the College of Veterinary Medicine, and three other colleges on campus. So it supports those three areas of activities. In addition, we often talk about the on-campus impact, but of course the Minnesota Ag Experiment Station and Extension and CFANS and CBM impact the entire state. This chart of Minnesota simply represents the areas that we have activities related to in every county, every region of the state. So it spreads across the economic development of the entire state. And just a quick overview of the types of activities that we do, going everywhere, as I call it, from the soil and water aspects all the way to human health and nutrition and everything in between that activity. I'll focus a little bit now more specifically on CFANS, and then we'll move to extension comments and then the College of Veterinary Medicine. And I will do this quickly. You do have the slides, so you can kind of parse those as you go. I'll try to hit the high points only. We are, of course, proud to be a part of the land-grant mission that affects not only the research side, but as well as teaching, and that's resident teaching in the case of CFANS, as well as outreach. As I said earlier, I'll skip a slide here. The key part of our activities in that research is based on our faculty. This gives some sense. We have 253 faculty in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. If you were to aggregate those, about 102 of those FTEs are committed to research, and that goes from basic research in genomics, microbiology, through applied sciences and applied research that goes to farm management and farm decision making, for example. 67 of those faculty FTEs are engaged in resident teaching, and then 26 are extension specialists, and that's a key link within extension and the college. Because that leads that applied research connection into extension programming and helps to move that through to the state. So there's a strong partnership historically there that carries through. The rest are either endowed, so we have a significant number of endowed chairs. That's funding that comes from gifts or other sources. And then MnDrive this past year, I'll note, that was funded by the legislature, also has helped to fund a significant number of faculty within the college. So that gives some sense of where those are. On this one, I'll also point out on the right side, people often forget that the Bell Museum of Natural History is within CFANS. It's an aspect of that. So this last year's bonding that went to the Bell Museum, that will be moving to the St. Paul campus as we begin planning for that. And we view that as a potential gateway to bring more people and connect them with the importance of natural resources as well as agricultural areas because of our fields and forestry research going on campus. So we're hoping to leverage and build public awareness through that. The landscape arboretum also is a key aspect of that. We are more broadly across the state. These are the research and outreach centers. There are 10 of those around the state, and again, very diverse and linked into the regions in particular of the state's activities. So Southwest Minnesota, for example, areas, of course, focused on cropping systems, organic cropping systems. The Northeast Corner Forestry, the Cloquet Forestry Research Center, engages in forest research and is particularly engaged in climate change and the impacts on our native forests and how those are affected by those, and then kind of everything in between along the way. I want to speak a little bit to our workforce development. That's a key area of importance for the college. We've recognized from industry, as you look at this slide, the bottom line, that every year we're facing about a 2,750 shortfall in graduates coming into agricultural fields. The diagram demonstrates where those are coming from, and that includes ag education is an important area. And we think of it as a pipeline, as many people do, of how do we get young people engaged through the science and technology that's becoming an important part of agriculture and into the fields of research, into the fields of education, into the government policy areas and business that are needed to support agriculture going forward. And many of those positions, as I talk through them, are relatively high-tech positions. And how do we appeal to students and get them engaged in agriculture? These are some of those areas. You see at the top of this, one of the things that I think students often don't think about is the role that robotics and engineering and IT plays. As you were watching the legislation on drone activities, that's an example of some high-tech research, not only the drones themselves, but the remote sensing that's conducted from drones to look at crop health, landscape issues of whether it's pests or diseases coming on there, and then on through the traditional plant sciences, farm management, and so on, that we see as fields we hear again and again that need young people coming out. Just a number, 15% of employment in agriculture is over the age of 65. And so it's very likely in the coming years that trend is going to continue and we'll need to refresh and look at education and then employment opportunities for those new people coming in. CFANS has 13 degree programs. Won't go through each one of these. Two key parts of that is we have several interdisciplinary programs. One is food systems, to help students and educate on, you know, from lower that soil side through the end final consumer nutrition side. And we hear more and more that industries and education wants to have people who understand that broader spectrum of what goes into food production and so on. And we also have others that are engaged in that as well that are cross-disciplinary. We also, with all of our students, require that they have an experiential learning component, which was new a couple of years ago, that they go out and work with industry, they work with government, for example, they work in communities to go out and engage in either, you know, applied research in those communities or to work with them on projects they may be trying to implement to really build their skills in leadership. Sorry about that, Mike. You can probably say it better than I can now. To build their skills in leadership and communication engagement and make them not only educated but improved citizens as they go out into the workforce. Our students, we have over 2,000 undergraduate students in the college. They're very high-quality students. I'm an alum of Iowa State University, but I would wager still that our students are higher quality than they have at Iowa State University. And that includes a composition of both Twin Cities region, rural students, international, so a very diverse student population coming in. In fact, the majority, of course, are not from farms anymore, just given the population demographics, and so a very diverse set of students coming in. We have very strong placement rates from our educational programs. 87% of graduates have jobs and 76% relating to their fields. Some of the disconnect that comes in there is, with all due respect to our College of Veterinary Medicine, students are going to professional schools and may not be admitted into those schools, and then they're looking for alternative career opportunities. So when they answer those questions, they're often looking at their major program and not to the broader potential use of their degrees in related areas. So there's some movement across that. This slide I want to explain just a little bit. We are the only university or college in the state that provides advanced degrees in ag, food, and natural resources. As it goes on, it looks like plant sciences, of course, were much broader than that. But this plant science is an example. This was a survey of several agricultural business firms in life sciences. It's called the Council on Sustainability and Agriculture Workforce. And this is the percentage of employees they're going to hire by degree over the coming years. So 46% of their hires are going to be in the area of doctoral students in plant sciences. And that's partly an indication as we look at seed technology and livestock technology, a lot of this coming through advanced biological processes, advanced crop protection methods, advancements in genomics. And so our challenge is we see fewer students coming into the agricultural sector, into the undergrad area. Those undergrad positions are in high demand, as was mentioned, with the growing economy. And then they don't show up in the advanced degree programs. And so we're trying to find ways to bring more students into those advanced degree programs because they are in demand and they're important for the development of our industries and farming in Minnesota. These are the scope of the grad programs that we do have. As you can see in that, several of these, again, relate from water resources up to, applied plant sciences, animal science, and everything in between again. Several of these are multidisciplinary. Again, recognizing that the grand challenge we're facing, if we're looking at agricultural systems and looking at natural resources, we need to have students trained and professionals trained who understand that broad scope of what's happening across that array of landscapes. I'm going to switch a bit to research, and this is a complicated chart, but as you heard earlier from testimony, I'm an economist, so I thrive on these. I apologize. But what I'm trying to build in that is the complexity of the interactions we have from that agricultural and natural resources perspective. And in CFANS, one of the pieces we have is we do have these very diverse fields that connect into, if we're thinking about water quality-related agriculture to agriculture or soil quality-related agriculture, on through to climate change, for example, if you think about the environment that's happening there. And what's really revolutionizing our research is that with informatics and technology that I've talked about, and that goes to farming systems through the basic research in genomics, that ability to measure and monitor and sense the various aspects of agriculture is allowing us to actually build an ecosystem. And if you think of those terms, because we know that ecosystems, as they thrive and interact, it's difficult to tease all apart what the interaction and feedbacks are between, the air, the environment, the water, the microbes, the plants that are in that ecosystem. We're starting to untangle some of that scientifically. So we're able to link together things like what's happening with the soil microbes that are affecting plant growth and plant traits that are coming into the food chain that are affecting the quality of that food chain. And so we really are at the university starting to link together those sciences to build those interactions and actually improve the productivity, again, happening both for our agricultural production systems, but you think about our natural resources and the value of those. And it also represents the interaction we have not only with within the college, but with industry, with government agencies that we're working with. We're partnering extensively with Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We're cooperating with DNR. for cooperating with agribusinesses and other firms, with natural resource science companies. So we're very much building that ecosystem of what we do, working with industry, working with government, and then across an array of science. And I think that builds a very unique resource for the state to be able to draw those threads together. And I often say when I'm visiting with a Syngenta or a Pioneer, for example, how much food research do you do? And very limited. It's on the crop technology side of it. You talk to General Mills. How much land research do you do on soils and microbes? Very little. We provide that resource to bridge some of those gaps. And from a policy and environment perspective, that has tremendous value across the industry. So we're really trying to build that ecosystem to be successful. We're making investments to do that. Again, one of our most important resources are our faculty, and this is just a list of some of the faculty we've hired. And I think if you look down that list, you'll see a representation of everything that just about anyone in this room can do. And we're trying to build those strategically so that they do align and intersect to achieve those ecosystem-type goals. I'm going to run through. Most of these are pretty well known. So the next few slides are mainly our core areas of research. I'll just hit the very top highlights. Of course, one of the grand challenges, the biggest one we see often, is global food security. So, of course, that's preeminent in looking at how do we improve the productivity of our food systems and get nutritious and healthy food to consumers, and we have significant investments across that array. Bioag informatics, I consider this the thread that holds many of these together, looking at engineering, technology, robotics, computational sciences. We're working extensively with the Minnesota Supercomputing Institute because they offer the fifth largest processing capacity for data in the world. And so we look at the landscape level issues with farming and agriculture and ecosystems, and we're starting to grab that data and manage it and start to analyze it and make decisions regarding these other areas. So a really key part of our role. We're advancing the reduction of invasive species. We had investments last year related to aquatic and terrestrial invasive species. And we're also seeking to advance biodiversity. You know, how do we improve the health of the landscape? Bee pollinators, of course, have been part of that. The pollinator habitat issues are part of that. There's a position that's coming in related to that to the college. And that extends to pest and disease pressures. We'll talk about climate change in a bit, but as we see climate changing, that allows more pests, for example, soybean aphids, other pathogens to come into the state that couldn't have survived here in the forest sector, western pine beetle, can gain a foothold here now. So we're looking at how do we address those issues related to pests and disease that reduce productivity. Water resources across the gamut of Minnesota, one of our most important resources, working extensively there. Climate change, renewable fuels are a key part of our research portfolio, and we're protecting the state. Soon, Dean Ames will talk, I'm sure, about the vet isolation labs. On the plant side and the insect side, we also have units that deal with pathogen isolation, a key part of protecting our food supplies. And so, for example, we can work on UG99, which is a wheat stem rust that affects crops in Africa now, but can easily transport on air currents and so on, potentially to the U.S., and other regions that affect our wheat supply. And we have the quarantine facility that can work on reducing those pathogens. And then at the end of this, of course, food safety and food supply issues are a key part of that as well. We try to draw that together through multidisciplinary centers. I encourage you to go to our website and look at those, but these centers help to draw, if we're looking at these interdisciplinary challenges, how do we draw those across from the campus to bring those together to be more effective in the work that they do. And finally, we are on all continents. This is just an example of plant pathology. But none of these diseases or invasive species now respect borders or boundaries. And certainly the demand for food supply and the environmental impacts of those don't respect boundaries. We were just reading yesterday about the air effects of pollution in China coming to the west coast of the U.S. All of these are transboundary issues, and so we're engaging with these across the globe to enhance that productivity and make investments there as well. A couple of quick slides on investments, and the big change here is simply that we're continuing to increase the levels of revenues generated by the university directly. Tuition, and that's through students, because obviously we've frozen tuition rates over the past few years. That's indirect cost recovery from grants and contracts are increasing, and then gifts and other activities with sales are increasing, as well as a share of our budgets over time. So we're aggressively moving to increase our potential to fund those pieces. From the state special perspective, the bottom right-hand chart is critical. For every dollar of state special funding that comes into CFANS, we generate about $2.50 in sponsored projects, so a significant leveraging of those funds. If you look at overall state funding that comes to CFANS, we match that dollar for dollar with sponsored projects and grants. So those dollars that are spent in the public are also leveraged across industry. I think Dean Ames will talk about MnDrive a bit more, but the MnDrive has had significant impacts on our college. It's brought faculty together. It's engaged industry partners, and we funded new faculty-related areas of agricultural productivity and sustainability. And I think the most impressive part is CFANS works across the university, so when they had a transdisciplinary call for proposals that worked across all three areas, CFANS was part of 10 of those 12 proposals, recognizing that the agricultural security food challenges are a key part, environmental natural resource challenges are a key part of the University of Minnesota's agenda more broadly and cuts across many of these areas. I mentioned the Minnesota Ag Experiment Station already. I'll just highlight one of the successful projects. I think the names may talk about this as well, as the rapid response funds that are used to address important issues in agriculture respond quickly. And that's been quite successful. Bovine TB is one of those that we eliminated from the state based on that. And to just wrap up, I think it's important to recognize a lot of the conversation this morning is about agricultural productivity. This chart of Minnesota shows that maroon part is the agricultural land in production now, 29 million acres in Minnesota in cropland production. If we had not had investments in science and technology, we'd have had to have had another 16.5 million acres in Minnesota brought into ag production. That would have, of course, displaced other activities in those lands. And so this agricultural productivity, if you think of that globally, is a key part of interacting with natural resources, preserving water resources, preserving land. And this next slide shows in the livestock sector, 60 and 70% reductions in carbon footprint based specifically on productivity-enhancing technologies. And so if we're going to feed this growing population, the science and technology side of this, the educational side, the extension side that takes to transfer to the farms and the use is critically vital for meeting that need. And the end goal, of course, is consumers and food, and that reduces the cost of food, improves nutrition, and has huge impacts. And that's why we feel that ag research and technology and extension, which I'll turn over to now, is so critical to that the future of Minnesota.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, and I did that as quickly as I could.
That was great. We have about 42 minutes left, so that's fantastic. We do have a couple questions, I think. First, Vice Chair Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boer, by the way, hello. You sent me an email to say that I should check out the Northwest Experiment
yes.
Station, and I have spent a considerable amount of time there, and they've employed a few of my children. Great job for college, and my daughter used to come home with very, very black fingers. It took forever to take that sugar dirt off of her fingers. In light of education, we've tried to promote sciences in the schools. Agriculture is part of a science class. And looking at that, connecting it with university and the education, what have you guys, has there been any improvement on improving agricultural education or directing students to go to school? There's a lot of opportunity there. I'm not sure students always know that opportunity is there. And what have you guys been working on?
Yes. Dean Boer.
Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, and thank you for supporting Northwest Research Outreach Center. I'm sure I hope your children have enjoyed it. On the education side, we've worked extensively to advance agricultural education training for students coming out to go into schools where in Minnesota we know there's a shortage of agricultural education instructors. I think one of our great challenges is, so that's been improving, and that program is growing dramatically. We also have a program called the Minnesota Youth Institute that's going into schools and trying to build awareness regarding agriculture and science and technology. And we're continuing to work on avenues to expand those programs and working with the K-12 system to build awareness. I think one of our great challenges is we've done survey work, and we know that one of the challenges is the perception of agriculture, that people see it almost solely as farming and rural, which, of course, a large part of the footprint is. And the other side of this is exactly what you're raising, the science and technology piece, that if students are interested in advanced sciences, microbial sciences, advancements in genetics, advancements in engineering, we think there's no better playing field to come to than agriculture and food production, because it's on the landscape, very diverse production systems, it's global, and we don't get that message out, I think, enough to students. So we're thinking about actually now we're working with a marketing firm to start to work with the industry and develop messages, sort of like the STEM message that's gone out, so everybody's into STEM now, and we'd like to turn it out to a STEM agriculture and food and natural resources as well, because there's huge demand for people in those areas. And I think oftentimes, because obviously the urban population is much greater, they don't see those opportunities coming out. So we're trying to build that through advancing more students in ag education, getting those teachers out there, and then trying to build awareness with some of our partners in agriculture to see those job and career opportunities.
put the A in STEM, and you have STEAM, put the STEAM behind
STEAM.
It,
yeah.
Vice Chair Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good point. STEAM would be just great. I am going to be, I have a university in my district, if anybody doesn't know that, and they had provided ag education at one point for, and the program kind of ended. I know it was kind of, it was small numbers, but even at small numbers, I think it's a valuable program, and I just for the members' encouragement, I talked to Dr. Woods at the University in Crookston quite often about being able to bring that program back. Because I do know that there are rural students that don't tend to come to the main campus and desire to look into college high school education, ag education, and we really need that in order to increase our student education. But I also think it would be great to be able to encourage PSEO, a concurrent education in ag, as maybe another avenue for our small schools that aren't going to necessarily be able to have an ag education program. Dr. Westrom at the University of Crookston actually tried to provide a program where schools could jointly have teachers for schools with one teacher, and he or she would be in each school one day a week. And then the fifth day, obviously, was an office day. And it worked for some of the small schools, became a problem. And then the students would have online classes. They'd have classes every day, but they would be online. And some of the schools were a little bit stretched to be able to provide that supervision for the students that were online. Because, you know, teenagers can find other things to do besides pay attention in class. It was an attempt at increasing ag education also. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean Buer. Buer or Burr? I'm sorry.
Buer.
Buer. I got it all wrong. Thank you for being here. A few years back, I was privileged and proud to be part of a group that put together the Mid-Central Research and Outreach Center in Wilmer. On the Midwest Technology Campus, which, by the way, Mr. Chair, if you ever want to see what bioscience and biotechnology can do in greater Minnesota and agriculture, go out to Wilmer sometime and see the Midwest Technology Campus. It's incredible what they're doing out there right now. So when we formed that facility, one of the core interests, one of the core identities of that was to bring private industry working with research components and other components of the land-grant mission of the University of Minnesota. You have Dr. Cardonis that I know is doing incredible work with gut health, turkey gut health work out there. One of the challenges that we found when we were putting this together was it can be difficult with technology transfer or IP agreements or contracts, and I know that there's been some efforts to improve so that private industry can work with the University of Minnesota to apply or even commercialize some of the stuff that, in fact, your scientists find. Can you just give us just kind of an update or an overview on how that relation, not specific necessarily to Wilmer, but just in general, how things are going with the University of Minnesota technology transfer, IP, all that sort of stuff?
No. Dean Buer.
Mr. Chair, I may defer to Dean Ames as well on this, but one of the things that Minnesota recently implemented was a MIN-IP program through the Office of the Vice President for Research to try and streamline IP approval and IP processes, and we go through that, of course, with Apples and other technologies that we develop in plant sciences. And what that does is try to basically up front, in a nutshell, is to, form the agreement to work on the joint projects together, and we're doing this in breeding programs now. And then rather than trying to parse out every possible contingency for what the IP is going along, up until I think it's the first $250 million in revenues, Trevor, you can correct me, up to some number, the work goes along at that point when there's actually money being generated from it. Then we worry about, that agreement. The point being that oftentimes in early R&D, you never get to that stage because you work on a research project that doesn't work out. And what we were doing, we were afraid of, was closing off so many opportunities to do new projects, worrying over what if somebody makes $1 billion and we're not part of it later on, that we didn't start the project. And one of those ideas to build, the ease of entering partnerships. and then the E isn't just a flat version of here's how we're going to manage that IP afterwards. So we're really trying to aggressively, through OVPR, advance those opportunities. Dean Ames may have some additional.
I think you.
Dean Ames.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, committee members. I think you described that really well. And basically, the concept is that we worry less about the front end, small increments of IP, and come to agreement on sort of what's referred to as the home run type IP issues. And I think the university in some analysis felt that over the last 10 years, this detailed negotiations around IP on these early projects probably had netted the university less than $10 million in that time period. So really, what Dean Boer said, it was dissuading interactions and not really getting a return on the investment.
Right, just thank you.
Mr. Chair, one more small, quick follow-up question.
A small, quick one, because we have two more testifiers, and I want to hear what they have to say.
And they can even follow up with this later, but does the university have any numbers on how many it's the Office of Technology Transfer is what it's called. Do they have reports on how many companies have been engaging in this, some of the numbers of this, and if they do, can they get that to us?
Dean Boer.
Mr. Chair, we can certainly follow up on that. I don't have it off the top of my head, but they do. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, can you hold your question until the end? Is that okay?
Anything for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. You're my new favorite. So if we could...
Mr. Chair, I'm sure it'll be short-lived.
If we could continue with the testimony, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, again, I'm Mike Schmidt, Associate Dean for Extension, also with CFAMS. It's a privilege to be here today to talk about Extension and to highlight some of the things that Extension's been doing this past year. It's very fitting to follow, Dean Boer and CFANS, because what Extension really takes pride in is that we set ourselves apart from other information organizations because we're a research-based organization. We take the research that's created on campus, and at our research and outreach centers and throughout Minnesota, and we put it into the hands of the people that are going to use the information. We look for those outcomes and the impacts. And in the next few minutes here, I want to just highlight some of these key things that we've been doing this past year. Not everything. It's way too, there's a time constraint here. But just some of the highlights of what we've been doing for this past year in our Extension, through research program. A couple key themes I hope you're going to see. Look for them. That's going to be about agriculture. What's going on in agriculture is one of the themes today. And the other thing that I'm going to highlight is leadership. And you're going to see some of those highlights as well as I go through. So look for them as I go. Extension is addressing many issues, and we like to say that they're relevant issues. We listen to the people around the state, and these are the issues that they want, the University of Minnesota to be conducting research and the subsequent education on. And you can see these here. And there are a host of other issues as well. Extension. We're over 100 years in the state, and you can see that we're throughout the state of Minnesota, including at Midwest there. We have a regional office in Wilmer there in the technology hub, out there in west central Minnesota. We like to say that we're throughout the state. We're the eyes and the ears, our staff and that throughout the state of Minnesota. We've got people throughout the state. It's not just here in Minnesota, in St. Paul, but over 800 faculty members, and 65% of these people are outside of campus here. 87 campuses, 15 regional offices, and Extension is embedded in 6 different colleges. Dean Boer just was talking about that in one of his slide charts about the FTEs in CFANS, and I think there were 26 FTEs, but that's spread out over almost 70 different Extension specialists. So there is this connection that Extension has throughout the state and throughout the University of Minnesota. But more importantly, it's not about our staff per se, it's who we're touching, who we're reaching in Extension. Over 700,000 direct participants in Extension programming this past year. Of that, 150,000 plus youth participants, and 34,000 volunteers, 1,000 advisory board members. What that does is it gives us engagement. We're out there in the counties. We're listening to people. They're telling us their issues. We're following up with that. You know, the volunteers in particular, they're critical to Extension's programming, whether it be in 4-H, Master Gardeners, Master Naturalists. Volunteers expand our workforce, very significantly. Just as a reminder, our budget for Extension, $68 million a year. You can see that we rely very heavily and significantly and appreciatively on that 40% that's coming, through the state. That's very important to our budget. Our budget is one that's been kind of on a steady state for a few years, and as Dean Durgan would say, the one that you got to look for there that's been increasing is our grants, contracts, and income. You know, Extension has been much more advantageous in writing grants, writing research grants, writing contracts with agencies, etc., and that's the line that's been increasing over the last 10 years during Dean Durgan's time leading Extension, that yellowish line there. So that's our funding trend right now. Extension, this is a real basic but important graphic that we like to show, and that's Extension combines that research and education together. You know, our education is not different until we link it to that research, but we got to complete that cycle, and our research and education is meaningless if we don't add the value to it. The way we're going to add value is by being relevant to the issues in the state of Minnesota. So, we believe that we need to seek that value through our research-based education programs. Okay, one of the focal points that I want to talk about today is leadership in Minnesota. University of Minnesota Extension has numerous leadership programs. From some of the more formal leadership programs to less formal, and that's our 4-H program. 4-H is a future leadership program. It's the future of our state is through our youth. I mean, it's just kind of a cliche, but we take this very seriously. When we take a look at our youth and their out of school time, a very critical period of time in a youth's life, how can we make that time more meaningful and significant to the future of our state? I want to just share a little bit about an ongoing question, and that is, what is the impact of 4-H versus non-4-H youth? And this is a research study that I'm going to show a couple of slides on that was done here in Minnesota, looking at that difference between Minnesota 4-H in Minnesota versus youth without 4-H. Research study, paired study that controlled for race, gender, grade level, socioeconomic status, etc. And the data was from Minnesota Departments of Education and Human Services. And I'll just cut to the chase and say 4-H youth were in a better place at the end of their youth period of time. This slide shows attendance rates between 4-H youth and non-4-H youth. Control for all those other things, 4-H youth were significantly better at attendance in school. Well, attendance is just kind of an indicator, but what about an outcome? Math scores are on the top graphic there. Again, significant differences in math comprehension due to these scores. Reading scores, again, significantly better for 4-H youth versus non-4-H youth, controlled over all the other factors. And that ultimately results in graduation. Graduation, is 96.3% for 4-H youth versus 85.5% for non-4-H in this paired study. Significant difference there. 4-H is making a significant difference in the youth in Minnesota. It's a future leadership program that we're proud to be running and associated with. Next, and this follows along with the 4-H, but 4-H youth are also more likely to go into the sciences. sciences are, we're also going to have more females, girls in sciences as well. And that is something that, again, we take great pride in having that, because 4-H encourages, the STEM or STEAM type disciplines. Recent story in Source Magazine, University of Minnesota Communications Magazine, about STEM projects and girls, and be more than happy to get that to anybody that might want to know more. And one of the newest projects in 4-H is the Science of Agriculture. We're recircling back to getting agriculture as a major program area in 4-H, and the Science of Agriculture is one of those that emphasizes youth and agriculture together. Okay, I'm going to switch a little bit. Other leadership programs, I don't want to ignore them. You're all familiar with MARL and Emerging Leader Programs. They're ongoing. They are ongoing and making a difference, both in the active people that are in this, as well as the cohort groups from previous groups. They are a lifelong cohort group that's being developed in these different programs. Farm Bill, I'm transitioning to agriculture now, because that is one of our major bread and butter programs at Extension, is our agricultural extension program. Farm Bill was key in 2014. 13,000 people, attended University of Minnesota Farm Bill education programs. This was worked through our Center for Farm Financial Management in collaboration with FSA and other organizations. We think that we made a difference. Working with the Center for Farm Financial Management, which is in the Department of Applied Economics, Dean Boer's discipline home at the University of Minnesota, they're the ones that are behind FinPAC. And FinPAC is that baseline software program and database that's driving agricultural management throughout the state through various outlets. Extension is also working with CFANS in meeting agricultural challenges. One of the things that I just want to add here on this particular slide is a lot of people might say, well, farmers don't use Extension anymore. The Extension is away from the farmers. And what I just want to state is that we've got plenty of data to say, while farmers may be relying less on Extension directly, the people that farmers do rely on, their fertilizer dealers, their crop consultants, their agency folks, etc., those people get the majority of their information from Extension. So while farmers may say, I don't use Extension, the people that they are using, Extension is critical to their success. Lots of issues in agriculture, whether it be from the super weeds, climate change, animal diseases. Extension is working with the various colleges and the faculty to address these issues around the state of Minnesota. Milk producers, big dairy summit last week on campus. Extension was part of that. We're helping to get that, the research from our researchers out to the hands of the producers. And then our agriculture, of course, leads to food, because food is what people eat. And our food safety, and again, I'm not going to go through these because Dean Boer went through these. We're growing healthier food, and that's going to translate to, farm-to-school programs, and then eventually to health, because we want, food leads to health, which leads to quality of life. Protecting pollinators, again, Dean Boer talked about that. We're also involved. We're hiring people as well in these areas. Invasive species, again, partnerships with colleges to make a difference around the state. I want to conclude here and just say that Extension is making a difference. I highlighted a couple programs today of where we're creating our great impact in agricultural programs and our leadership program, especially through 4-H. Key things this past year were, in those two areas, and we look forward to, just growing our efforts and talking about more of these in the future. So, thank you.
All right, thank you. I do have some questions, so I'm going to hold them until after we hear from Dean Ames. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's certainly appreciate this opportunity to report on the College of Veterinary Medicine, but also to really thank the state for its support of the Agricultural Experiment Station and the Minnesota Extension at the University of Minnesota. We strive to fulfill our land grant mission at the Veterinary College by keeping the animals of the state healthy. We believe that by doing so, we keep the economy healthy, and also by keeping the animals healthy, we keep the citizens of the state healthy through a safe food supply. I think most of you know that the College of Veterinary Medicine is the only place in the state where veterinarians can be educated. We also train a significant number of graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, and we do also get involved in a lot of training of interns and residents that go into specialties like pathology and surgery. Most of our students come to us with an undergraduate degree. Our largest supplier of students is CFANS, and we then have 4 years to get them practice ready. So this requires an extensive investment in clinical training, and it's especially significant in a state like Minnesota where we have so many strong sectors of animal agriculture. I could say that if you're a veterinary college at the University of Wisconsin, you might just focus on dairy, but we focus on dairy, swine, poultry, and beef. And so we do invest in this. The majority of our graduates, when they graduate, about two-thirds of them go directly into the workforce, but a third of them do go on to get additional training, whether it's in graduate school or additional specialty training in the clinical disciplines. We do rely heavily on public-private and public-public partnerships to help us with this clinical training. But I do want to emphasize that our diagnostic lab and our hospital are some of the busiest and highest ranked in the nation, and so they provide the core of our clinical training sites. We're especially proud of our partnership with Davis Family Dairy. This education facility has received additional funding through USDA to be classified as a National Center of Excellence for Veterinary Dairy Education, and certainly helps us deliver that education to students interested in dairy practice. A couple of areas where there are important workforce challenges and needs in the state are food animal veterinarians and public health veterinarians. And in conjunction with CFANS, we've developed a very successful early admission pipeline program for food animal students called VetFast. And this program is successfully placing food animal students, food animal veterinarians into the state working in that sector. And you can see from the slide that we've had a good number of students go on in that, and we've got a good number that continue to come in through the pipeline program and that are currently in CFANS in the pre-veterinary part of this program. Interestingly, the top area that we get scholarship funding from alumni is for this VetFast program. Even companion animal veterinarians have given large amounts of money to this program because of the value they see in it for the state and the profession. And I do want to highlight that the former state-funded veterinary loan forgiveness program also had been an important way of supporting veterinarians going into the rural areas. We've also partnered with the School of Public Health to create a joint DVM Masters of Public Health program. We graduate about 4 to 8 of those students who've earned both degrees in 4 years. And so like the VetFast program, the joint degree program actually saves the students time and money, and it is by far the largest of these types of programs in the nation. Not only do we train students in our veterinary college, but 8 other veterinary colleges. We're certainly happy to help schools like Cornell out when we can. So I do want to just move on and talk a little bit about research. We do focus our research into 3 main areas, and 2 of these directly impact agriculture: emerging diseases and population systems that focuses on livestock and poultry and food safety directly focus on agriculture and are, as you can see, intersecting areas of focus for the college. The college has certainly used its research programs to support many of our missions, and we are a highly ranked college in terms of the nation's veterinary colleges for our research programs. And we are able to use funds that come to us through the Agricultural Experiment Station and the Rapid Ag Response Funds to respond quickly to emerging disease threats like the porcine epidemic diarrhea virus that we dealt with over the last 2 years and was featured in a collegiate publication called Profiles. We take the money that we receive from the Agricultural Experiment Station and we invest that strategically through a competitive grants project program within the college. And over the last 5 years, we've been able to use those funds to leverage additional research funding. And we funded over 150 projects, and we believe that the return rate on the investment we've put into that with gaining additional federal research dollars is about a 3-to-1 investment. Dean Boer and Associate Dean have also discussed the research projects, and so I don't need to go through these, but certainly you can see some of those on the slides that we've dealt with in terms of infectious diseases, and including porcine epidemic diarrhea virus, the light turkey syndrome, looking at the turkey gut genome that was previously mentioned, and porcine circovirus. Obviously now we're very concerned about avian influenza, but we've worked on projects surrounding swine influenza as well. And now there's emerging issues and concerns and research focusing on antibiotic resistance. Well, I wouldn't be doing my job as dean if I didn't talk about the importance of the university's capital bonding request and the funding request to support the veterinary isolation labs or the veterinary isolation facility. This is a facility that is essential for us to conduct infectious disease research to serve the state as well as to attract top faculty and to be competitive for research funding. It's the only facility in the state where infectious disease research on any animal bigger than a rabbit can take place. And I've given you a handout that gives you detailed information on this request, but I think you can see from the handout that what was once a state-of-the-art facility in 1958 is no longer adequate to meet the state's needs and to support agriculture in the state. Our Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory is an important service organization for the state. It's the official lab of the Board of Animal Health, and it's partially funded by a different state special that comes through the Academic Health Center at the University of Minnesota. But as you can see from the slide, it conducts research and surveillance surrounding a wide variety of species and issues. It provides testing results that are used in everyday livestock management for the agricultural industry. It also serves as a very important training site and discovery site for the state. So with diseases like high-path avian influenza now in California poultry flocks, we've got avian metapneumovirus back in our turkey flocks. I've just mentioned porcine epidemic diarrhea virus and PRRS virus affecting our swine industry. And we've even got newly discovered diseases like bee paralysis virus that the diagnostic lab is working on. You can see that it's always busy supporting the state and agriculture. We've got a number of service centers at the veterinary college or that we collaborate with, like our Center for Animal Health and Food Safety, the National Center for Food Protection and Defense, and a collaboration with the School of Public Health, the Upper Midwest Safety and Health Center, that all help support agriculture in our state. And we do appreciate the funding support that we get from Minnesota Extension, and we do use this to support to support extension efforts in the area and with faculty in the areas of dairy, poultry, swine, food safety, and aquaculture. And we are able to host many conferences, workshops, meetings, on-farm training sessions, and we've reached over 3,000 attendees in the last year. We also offer a number of online policy briefs, CE and extension courses that are offered online, and we've created a lot of fact sheets. So as Dean Boer mentioned, with his college, there are many, many important sources of funding. You can see from the materials that you've been provided that the college receives about 19% of its support from the state, if you include the support that we get from the Agricultural Experiment Station, Minnesota Extension, and our Veterinary Diagnostic Lab State Special. So that ends up giving us about 17% from tuition, 20% from federal research grants, and we are unique at the university in that we do run a number of large service organizations like the diagnostic lab and the hospital, and so we get over 30% of our budget for from just clinical income that we generate. Notable trends that have occurred is an increase and decrease in research funding that was largely affected by the stimulus money that we received in 2009 and 2010, heavily associated with NIH grants, although still overall our research funding is up over the last 5 years. We've got a very significant increase in our clinical income associated with increased volume of work in the diagnostic lab and the hospital. We've had an increase in tuition income, mostly associated with increased students. We have seen a loss in state support that was somewhat buffered recently by increased state support directed towards our diagnostic lab. This support was vital for the function and success of the diagnostic lab, but unfortunately couldn't be used to help our students. So I'll just close by, as Dean Boer mentioned, talking just briefly about the MnDrive money. This was really important support that we received in the last biennium, and it was intended to help Minnesota's economy through research and workforce development. And we especially thank you for the funds that were directed at food production. And in the area of funds directed at food production, it was really intended to focus on increasing production, decreasing and managing animal and plant pathogens, developing novel food processing strategies, and to strengthen Minnesota's agricultural workforce. And funds are being used now for faculty, they're being used for graduate students, they're being used for grants that support research, commercialization, and workforce development. And just to give you an example of the types of things, the innovative things that have come about, Dean Boer mentioned the interdisciplinary grants that CFANS was very successful in. This is another example of basically a grant that was a commercialization opportunity that's basically engineered probiotics. And so by researchers in the Department of Chemical Engineering and Material Sciences working with faculty in the Veterinary College, we're seeing if we can use a targeted approach so that we can replace antibiotics in controlling salmonella. So that would be exciting if Minnesota became a leader in reducing antibiotic use in livestock with this type of funding. And then finally, another example is just a workforce development one that is focusing on a professional master's program around a master's in food systems so that the graduates coming out of the University of Minnesota can have a better understanding of the food industry and its regulations. So thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about the College of Veterinary Medicine and its programs, as well as Extension and the Agricultural Experiment Station.
Thank you. We do have a couple questions. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been some discussion here about research facilities around the state. Well, in Roseau County, we have the Magnuson Research Farm, and I know that some of you are familiar with that. And some of the things that are going on there are really kind of cutting edge, Mr. Chair, and maybe at some point in the future we can ask for some sort of report and maybe have something before the committee. You know, you've been up and you've ridden ATVs in my area. I appreciate that. I don't know that I can get you a ride on a drone, but we are using those up there at the Magnuson Research Farm. I'm curious to know, Dean Boer, what do you think can come of the imagery and the systems that are being used there. For the people that don't know, the Federal Aviation Administration has given Roseau County permission to use drones up there, and there's a lot of partnerships going on with the local farmers and the University Magnuson Research Farm. Can you give us some idea of what you're looking for there and what the possibilities are? It's some really cutting-edge technology.
Dean Bohr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. Yeah, we're excited that the prospect of using drones continuing and ongoing, because it is a key part of that is understanding what are the, as we look at larger cropping systems, so in your area, of course, with, you know, thousands of acres of land in a given farm, to be able to identify, for example, early detection of pathogens or including insects and so on and what the damage is by those. And so the technology is moving towards advanced super imagery, so the ability to pixelate more clearly in a video image what the characteristic is of maybe being able to discern between different rust traits and so on. And what that requires, again, is back to this computational capacity, is the ability then all those pixels that come into those images are analyzed computationally to derive what that result or what you're observing is. And so we're going to see advancements from an engineering side come to, you know, one, the use of drones, the imaging technology, the computational technology, and that leads again to the biological technologies for control and so on that go with it. So I think the prospects of that are enormous for productivity, because it gets to that issue of a lot of issues we have are things that just go undetected, that they're hard to observe. If you're not out scouting all the time, you think about crop scouting traditionally, really advances that technology. And at the Magnuson Farm, of course, you know, part of that is, you know, the grass seed industry up there that's a critical part of it, and also research I know going on with Forever Green that's interesting related to intermediate wheatgrass production in that area. We're looking at can we improve soil quality, soil fertilities, and then come up with food products. And I mention that because if you were to talk to researchers, just about everything we do now goes through that cycle of what's happening with the environmental issues, what's happening with sustainability of our productivity systems with that, coming back into food ingredients, and then the technology side from robotic sensors and remote sensing.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's really interesting to see all the partnerships that are going on. Dave Grafstrom at Northland Community and Technical College, I know, is doing a lot of work with you guys, and there's a partnership with they're doing work at UMC in Crookston, at the University of North Dakota, so it's really some neat stuff. I had the opportunity last summer to visit the RDO dealership in Moorhead, and we went out and they did a demonstration on the precision that they can fly these unmanned aerial systems by going out and putting corners in and so forth and flying back and forth and do the push a button, it returns and come and land exactly where it took off from. So it's really very, very interesting. I do have one other question,
Representative.
It's actually more of a comment, and this is for Dean Ames. On a very serious note for me personally, I had a former student who applied to the veterinary school at the University of Minnesota after completing all of their undergraduate work. I don't remember what college it was here in the state of Minnesota. They met all of the entrance requirements, and they were rejected. They did not get in. They wound up at Iowa State University, and I had some conversations with representatives of the university after that, because the parents brought this concern to me. Here's a young kid from Roseau, Minnesota, who applied, didn't get in, went to Iowa State. And I was told by the university that maybe a part of the reason was that they didn't get in is that they are interested in having students from all around the country come to the university veterinarian school. And I appreciate that. But I don't know if you have any quota systems there. That's my first question. Either written or unwritten, do you have quotas for who gets into the veterinary school?
Dean Ames.
Yes, thank you. At any given time, about 66% of our students are Minnesota students, and so we definitely are interested in getting the best students we can out of Minnesota, and have certainly placed programs in place like the VetFast program that basically if those students are good students in high school, do well in their first semester in CFANS, then we hold a spot for them. So when we go to fill our class of around 100 students, if there's 10 qualified students or 15 qualified students in the VetFast program in CFANS, then we only have 85 slots left to fill. So I very much understand your concern. I have two children that wanted to go to medical school in the University of Minnesota, and neither one of them did. And so I understand that it's a challenge aligning students and positions within these colleges. The different colleges have different ways of accepting students. Within our veterinary college, we have an initial cut that we looks at academics, both how they've done in their pre-veterinary requirements, how they've done on a standardized test score called the graduate record exam, which is sort of the university equivalent of the ACT. And then once they clear that hurdle, then the next hurdle is what kind of experience they've had, life experience, veterinary experience, animal experience, what kind of reference letters they have. And then once they clear that hurdle, then the last hurdle is, so this year we had about 1,000 applicants for 100 slots. We're interviewing 300 students. We have a one-hour structured behavioral interview with two interviewers that have to have inter-interviewer agreement. And this interview selects for students that have professional attributes that predict for success in the profession. So we spent a lot of time developing that interview, perfecting it, and utilizing it. And so different students do well in different selection processes, and that's why some students end up at other universities.
Members, we're at the top of the hour. Representative Fabian, is this something you can visit offline?
We'll follow up offline.
Yes. Thank you so much, Representative Applebaum.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dean Ames, I apologize. I know it's time to go, but I'd really be remiss if I didn't I don't know, make a statement and just ask you a quick question. You know, you mentioned before the tall academic standards at your institution, which precludes many students from getting in. But, you know, for many students pursuing a degree, particularly a graduate degree, is no longer a smart financial investment. And in fact, according to the United States Department of Education, a vet student living below the poverty level and paying tuition at the University of Minnesota will pay over $240,000 in loans and interest over a 10-year period in order to receive their DVM. Of course, interest rates for graduate students are between 6.2% and 7.9%, and unlike for undergraduate schools, accrue when distributed instead of being deferred till after graduation. So I suppose my comment and question for you is, what scholarships and otherwise grant opportunities are offered to students so they can afford to attend your school and get involved in their career in veterinary medicine, which of course is such a critical part to our state, and what solutions do you suggest in lessening that burden?
Thank you. Dean Ames.
It's an extremely serious issue, and it's something that the profession is having a lot of discussions about. And so last year we did freeze our tuition. We were one of two professional schools at the university that did that. And not only did we freeze it, we reduced our senior fourth year tuition. It's something that we would like to be able to do again this year, and hope that we'll receive some help in doing that. Basically, you touched on a major point, and that's the interest rates on student loans, and the fact that those can't be renegotiated. That's a big part of it. Our school has historically been in, you know, the top six or seven in terms of the cost of our veterinary school. And there's two reasons for that. One is that we've consistently been in about the bottom third in terms of state funding for veterinary schools. And so when we look across at other veterinary schools in the nation, there's many that receive significantly higher state support. The other reason is that we do have a broad program that we do allow training in a broader array of disciplines for our students, and so that does add some additional costs within our program. So certainly Keeping student debt down is a major factor. It's been a big push of mine is to increase student scholarships, and so, you know, on average now we're giving out about $400,000 a year in scholarships. When I took over, we were giving out about $150,000, but that's nowhere near enough, and so this is something that I'll continue to push on. The other way of dealing with this is through loan forgiveness programs. There is a federal loan forgiveness program for veterinarians that funds about 60 veterinarians a year. So that's for the entire country. Minnesota, as I mentioned, did have a veterinary loan forgiveness program that was in place for one biennium before the state ended up dealing with the more significant effects of the recession. And so that would be another option if that could be renewed.
Thank you, Dean Ames. And Representative Applebaum, I think Representative Metza is going to be introducing a bill to address that very issue with some loan forgiveness for large animal vets, I believe. So we'll visit with Representative Metza
on that
as well.
Thank you for your answer.
Thank you. Gentlemen and Dean Durgan, thank you so much for being here today. With your help and with the governor's help and the Senate's help and the Department of Ag's help and my friends around the table here, we're going to put agriculture back on top again. So thank you so much. We are adjourned.